Hey, I'm Scott.
And I'm Jamie, and this is our new podcast, You're Gonna Need a Bigger Bottle, where we pair movies with wines and then talk about them.
This is our first episode. We recorded this and the next four back in the long, long ago of late 2020, before we'd come up with a name for the show or worked out the kinks in our recording process. So if things sound a little bit bumpy, that's why, and it's Jamie's fault.
We hope you dig the show. If you do, please rate, review, and subscribe. Follow us on social media at Bigger Bottle Pod. Try not to miss any episodes because they're pretty great, except for Scott's parts. Cheers.
Cheers.
I need to stop you for a second because you said something that was distressing to me. That you guys don't eat the dark meat?
Not normally. We use it in soup. Like, I'm not a dark meat person. She isn't really either.
What the fuck is wrong with you?
I like the breast meat.
The dark meat is where the flavor is.
Which is why I put it in my soup.
You have to work to get flavor into the breast. But the flavor is already there in the thigh. When I buy chicken, more often than not, I just buy the thighs. Because A, it's cheaper. And B, it tastes better.
I think it has more flavor. I don't think chicken thigh tastes better. I also don't think turkey thigh tastes better, though I like both.
Hot take from Jamie, fuck chicken breasts.
Wow.
On a flavor note and also on a sustainability note,
fuck
chicken breasts. They're bullshit.
Hot take from Jamie. He's cracking out the takes. All right. All right. I think that's enough preamble.
All right. Why don't you introduce yourself with your bitch ass?
Yeah, don't call me a bitch ass. Hello. Welcome to the podcast. I'm Scott. Prior to the pandemic, I ran movie theaters for first-run theaters and for film festivals in Philadelphia for 10 years. And then the pandemic came along, and I ain't got no job anymore.
And my name is Jamie. I have run restaurants and beverage programs in and around Philly for something in excess of 10 years, although sometimes it feels like an entire lifetime. March 16th, lockdowns happen, and my ass got laid off too.
Yeah. So we're staying home. We think everyone should probably be staying home as much as you can.
Definitely. Not probably, definitely.
Definitely. If you're listening to this, you should be staying home. If you're listening to this while you're, I don't know, at the gym or on your way to the party or to fucking Target, please turn this podcast off and consider yourself punished. So we're staying home. Everyone should be staying home. And the way that I am passing the time in the quarantine is watching great movies. And the way that Jamie passes the time all the time, but especially during quarantine, is drinking excess amounts of good wine.
It's important to note that it's good wine, because if it was bad wine, then you would call me an alcoholic. But because it's good wine, then we know that I'm a professional.
Right. There are no alcoholics who drink good wine.
No, they None all of them. Drink... like garbage out of a box.
Exclusively bad wine alcoholics. There are no rich alcoholics.
None certainly that I have ever met in my experience in fine dining.
Okay. But so enter this podcast where we want to tell you what you should be watching that probably flew under your radar already. In a bit of weird synesthesia, Jamie is going to recommend a dope bottle of wine that hopefully pairs well with the movie we think you should check out.
We're gonna give that a shot. Wine and movie pairings.
Yeah.
I think it's fun. Scott thinks it's fun. We think you should think it's fun. So, Scott, what movie did we watch?
We watched Marriage Story. This is the 2019 Noah Baumbach written and directed film, premiered at the Venice Film Festival. It's a drama sort of in the mold of like Kramer versus Kramer. It's Adam Driver and Scarlett Johansson, and they are a couple who right at the beginning of the movie are beginning their divorce proceedings, and it follows them through a bi-coastal custody battle, and it's heartbreaking and beautiful and very funny, and it was my favorite movie of last year. And even though it got a bunch of Oscar noms and was one of the more talked about movies of last year, I still keep running into people who are like, oh yeah, I never saw that. Or what is, like, people just, it's Netflix, so it didn't do a huge theatrical bow, and who knows how many people actually saw it, but I feel like it needs a little more advocacy.
Although if you are in a deep depression, I might recommend steering clear of this movie for a little bit.
Yeah. We'll get into that. We're gonna have to have a whole discussion about the crying and the waterworks. Jamie, what did you pair with this movie? What wine did you select to go with Marriage Story?
All right. So Scott gave me some words about this movie before we watched it, or he had seen it, I hadn't seen it, and that's likely going to be the case for most of the things we do on this show.
I should think so.
But I chose...
Well, hang on. So I gave you... The words that I gave you were aching and balanced. I'm trying to give Jamie descriptors that maybe describe movies in ways that are not, like, exclusive to movies. And I thought maybe that... I've heard you use all kinds of pretentious adjectives to describe wines. So I thought those would point you in the right direction. Aching and balanced.
Yeah, for sure. It's aching and balanced. And I took those along with the brief synopsis that you gave me. And I chose Arnaldo Capri, Montefalco Rosso, 2016. So this is a wine from Italy. It's from central Italy, one of the very few landlocked areas called Umbria, a hill basically in the center of Umbria called Montefalco, which is famous most for the Sagrantino grape, of which there is about 30% in this blend, but it's comprised mostly of Sangiovese with a little bit of Merlot as well. We'll talk a lot more in specific, and I'm sure that some of you will go cross-eyed while I say pretentious wine terms. But we're gonna start by talking about the meal, which is in this case the movie.
It is a meal, right?
It's a whole meal.
It is a fully gratifying experience. I find it satisfying on just about every level that you could find a movie for something that is so small and intimate. So if you have not seen it, I highly recommend it. I will say we'll talk in details about some of the plot points, although it's not really a plotty movie. I don't think it's something that can be spoiled. I think that there are people who would disagree with me, but like you can't spoil the highlights of the movie. Like it's all about it's not that they fight that is a spoiler. It's what they fight about and how the performances are and how it's written. So I don't think it can be spoiled. I guess we'll leave out whether or not there's no leaving it out. They get divorced. It starts with them getting divorced. They're never not getting divorced, and it's just how we get there.
It's a whole story about them getting divorced.
It opens with this exquisite 8-minute-long montage that is just your two main characters, Charlie and Nicole, Adam Driver and Scarlett Johansson, and they are each, it is revealed, reading a letter that they have written about the other, describing why they first fell in love in the first place. And so you see, I believe it starts with Nicole. No, it starts with Charlie talking about Nicole. Because that first shot is Scarlett walking. She's on stage, right? And she's walking into that, like, incredible spotlight. So it's Charlie talking about Nicole and all the ways that he loves her. And then Nicole talking about all the things that she fell in love with Charlie. And then we cut to... They're in a divorce mediation room, and this is a recommendation from the mediator as a way to bring them to a place of love and to remind them that they don't want to fight about the divorce, which is ultimately what they end up spending like the entire rest of the movie doing. But so he is a highly respected up-and-coming avant-garde New York theater director whose big adaptation of Elektra that she is the star of is about to go to Broadway. She's now a stage actress. She was about to become like the new ingenue Hollywood starlet 10 years ago when she met him. They fell in love. She quickly relocated from LA to New York. They have a kid named Henry, who I think is supposed to be like 8, maybe.
He's supposed to be exactly 8. It's stated 8 in the movie a couple of times. Yeah.
Yeah. And
if you were listening, which clearly you weren't.
Well, I mean, I was taking notes. I was drinking this wine. I was having thoughts about this wine. I was smelling the wine. Occasionally, I was crying.
Yeah, you got to have a good cry with this movie. That's actually what pairs well with this movie, is a good cry.
Is a good cry. But yeah, and so the movie opens and they do their last performance and they're separating. Nicole takes Henry with her out to LA where her sister and her mom are while she's filming this pilot. And that's where things kind of go off the rails. She meets with a divorce lawyer who's played by Laura Dern.
Speaking as a person who has grown up with Jurassic Park, Laura Dern is the quintessential heartthrob for me.
You got a big old crush on Laura Dern?
I will always be in love with Laura Dern. Always and forever.
So she hires this lawyer played by Laura Dern who comes in and she's almost like a predator. Like she presents sweet and warm and kind, and but she's immediately this is like one of the big running subplots and themes of the movie is about the divorce industrial complex, and Charlie ultimately is forced to hire a lawyer, and instead of it just being the two of them trying to settle things, it becomes a battle between high priced lawyers that are bleeding them out and making them fight. And there's a line in the movie that I think it's the Ray Liotta character. Ray Liotta is the high-priced, Ray Liotta-esque scumbag lawyer that Charlie ultimately ends up hiring.
But the great thing about the Ray Liotta character is he goes to see him first after Nicole hires Laura Dern, and he's absolutely repulsed. But and I picked this up on my second watch, if you flip your perspective, like if you're viewing this movie from Charlie's perspective, there's a narrative. And if you're viewing this movie from Nicole's perspective, there's a totally other narrative. And for Ray Liotta, he's the same thing that Laura Dern is, except he's a man.
Yeah.
He hasn't ever had to soften himself, so he can just nakedly be a predator.
Right, which is what that big Laura Dern monologue is near the end of the movie, which is when Nicole is rehearsing. You find out that she's rehearsing her answers for a court-appointed observer to witness both of them, and that'll help the judge make decisions about custody. And Nicole gives a few answers, and Laura Dern steps in, and she's like, look, I get it. Like, sometimes you have one drink more than you should, and sometimes you get mad at your kid and you think he's an asshole. I get it. I've been there. But you can't do that because we have to be perfect. And it's like this huge rant that kind of it layers in a character who up until that point had been a little cartoonish.
Yeah.
It's something I like so much about the Liotta character and the Laura Dern character is that they are allowed to be like liberated by the script, which is like it allows them to be broad cartoons. They're between their costuming and they're just their aesthetic and their casting and all of our associations with them and like their long careers. Like those characters are playing very broad and playing to the cheap seats. It gives laughs, it gives levity, it gives contrast in the movie, while Nicole and Charlie are just so naturalistic and so grounded. Like we live in their pain while this whole other like high legal drama is taking place on top of it. That tonally is at odds, I think, with their pain. Their interactions and all the stuff with them is so mundane and grounded and down to earth. And then the lawyers are like these big cartoon characters with thick black outlines.
Well, it's kind of purposefully way, right? Like the whole thing is that in the beginning, they decide not to go with lawyers. Then she goes to L.A. and one of her, I don't know, production assistants or producers or something.
I think it's one of the producers on her show, yeah.
Yeah, pulls her aside and gives her Nora's number, Nora being the Laura Dern character.
Right.
And then it turns into this big, broad, as you say, black outline kind of thing. But like the interesting thing that comes about after Charlie rejects Ray Liotta the first time is he goes to Alan Alda.
Right. Alan Alda, who is just magic. Like, is there anybody more reliable as a character actor than Alan Alda? He's so funny.
Viewing the movie for the first time, I definitely took it from a Charlie-centric point of view.
Yeah.
I was very moved initially by Nicole's sort of account of their relationship.
Yeah.
Because I relate to it in a lot of ways, but I was taken in by the Charlie character, and he meets Alan Alda, and I breathed a sigh of relief. Like, this guy's going to take care of him.
Yeah.
He's going to make it okay. He's got all of this experience, like...
And he's a human being, too. He's very warm.
He's a lawyer, though, that's been divorced three times, and there's, like...
Yeah.
There's that sort of question mark on his judgment.
Right.
But he's so warm and he's so lovely. And then he shits the bed legally.
Yeah. She hires like a predator. And Charlie comes in with like a nice avuncular, like grandpa type character who is just not equipped for that kind of bloodshed. You were talking about how you were with Nicole and her side of the story in the beginning. And that's something that a lot of people talked about. Like immediately there was this question of like, whose side are you on? It's the adult drama version of Civil War. Like, whose side are you on? Are you Team Charlie or Team Nicole?
I'm not on anybody's side.
Let me read you something. This is from Justin Chang, who is a film critic for the LA Times, who is terrific. And he was writing about the balance between the two characters. Chang said, perhaps the surest sign of Baumbach's integrity is that he refuses to provide an easy answer. His writing has rarely been more incisive, and it has almost certainly never been more generous or forgiving. Nicole's aggressive legal strategy may strike you as too calculating by half, unless you understand it to be a long overdue act of reclamation by a woman tired of putting her own needs and dreams aside. Driver's performance does achieve the deeper, more lingering impact, in part because Charlie is granted the courtesy of more screen time, but that may well be because he has the most learning and growing to do. He definitely has more screen time. It's like the first act of the movie is Nicole's, and then there's a handoff moment where she hands off the movie to him.
It's when he gets served.
He gets served. She hands him the papers. He leaves. And then it becomes Charlie's movie for basically the rest of the movie. It's his story. Like, she comes back in and she has great scenes.
And I think that it speaks to the power of her performance and her stardom and all of it that until you said a couple of minutes ago that she had less screen time, I hadn't given it a thought.
Yeah. It's front loaded in her favor. She gets all that screen time up front. She gets that amazing long scene, the first scene in Laura Dern's office where Laura Dern was really like, tell me your story. And she takes off those like spiked murder heels and climbs up on the couch next to her.
After apologizing for looking like a schlub.
Right, looking like a schlub.
Which is just hysterical.
This just reminds me, Nicole and Charlie, like both of them look like real people. I think the makeup work is exceptionally subtle in this movie where they are allowed to look real, like Driver's skin is blemished and has, you know, warts and things that I feel like I haven't seen on him, for example, in the Star Wars movies or some of his other high-profile work. Scarlett, in that scene, she looks like she's been crying the whole time, probably because she had just done 5 other takes of that shot. But, like, they're allowed to look weathered and pained and not perfect.
Despite being, like, objectively beautiful humans, and the movie even winks at that when they come back to their babysitter who's like, God, you guys are so attractive.
The babysitter, who is surprised that they have come home early, stands up and then buckles her pants back up and then says, oh my God, you're so attractive. Like,
yeah, I thought that was weird.
All right, and Scarlett just walks away and Charlie's like, it's okay. Don't worry about it. It's so weird.
So Scarlett, incredible performance, fills up the whole movie despite having less screen time.
She is so unbelievably great in this movie. It's such a fully realized character that plays to all of her strengths.
She's fully shed the need for there to be sex appeal in her performance.
Right.
Not that there isn't any, but like her presence is really all that's needed.
Right.
And then Driver, who has sort of existed in sort of an era of film that I haven't engaged with as much, just because of like who I am. Yeah. But like over the last couple of weeks, I've watched 3 different, like massively different Driver performances, from The Last Jedi to Logan Lucky and now to this. The dude has got talent.
He's got mad range. Do you know his deal, his story?
I have no idea about his deal or his story. Give me some context.
He was a Marine.
Really?
After 9/11, this is according to his IMDb bio, which in theory is submitted by his people. After 9/11, he enlisted in the Marines, serving for more than 2 years before being medically discharged after he suffered an injury which prevented him from being redeployed. He attended University of Indianapolis for a year and then transferred to study drama at Juilliard. He graduated in 09, and he did a little bit of acting and on Broadway before his breakout role in Girls, the HBO Lena Dunham show.
Wow.
In 2012, he's in a Law and Order and small roles in 5 movies, including Francis Ha, which was the first time he worked with Noah Baumbach.
Right.
But then Francis Ha, he has like a medium-sized role. He has a couple of good... No, he just has the one great scene in Inside Llewyn Davis.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Outer space. That's his whole bit. Him and JT and Llewyn Davis.
I have basically forgotten that entire movie.
It's my favorite Coens by far. I love it so much.
I'm going to have to give it a watch. Anyway, so Inside Llewyn Davis, and then...
He shows up again in Baumbach's next movie, While We're Young, which is not a great movie, in 2014. And then 2015, he's Kylo Ren. And then he has this insane run where he's in like 3 or 4 movies a year, every year after that. He's great in Logan Lucky. He's amazing in Silence, the Scorsese film. It's him and what's his name? Andrew Garfield. He's great in that. Right. He should have been the lead in that movie. Kills it in Black Klansman in a great supporting part. He was in The Report last year, which is a pretty good movie that he's great in. And then Marriage Story is just like, I've always been all in on Adam Driver, but like after this, I'll just watch him in fucking anything. He's unbelievable. There's this amazing thing. Let me go back to this Justin Chang review, because he has this great description of Driver. The actors seem to know the characters just as intimately as Baumbach. Nicole may seem the more recessive figure at first, but in Johansson's tremulous but forceful performance, her easygoing vibe can suddenly harden into steel. Charlie is louder and brasher, but also more guileless. And Driver uses his towering Franken physique to suggest both a figure of authority and an overgrown child. What a piece of writing that is.
I was going to make that point later. I completely agree with it. It's right there on screen. Like when there's a shot of the two of them standing even against each other. And I think the best example I can think of is in the kitchen after he just got served.
Right.
Because that's the first time you see him as a child. He walks into the house as this towering adult man who's in control of his life and everything. And then in 1 second, he gets served with divorce papers, his entire posture changes, and Nicole is in command. It's a finger snap. It's crazy.
It's a huge reversal in their dynamic that we'd only seen glimmers of the whole time. But yeah, that pivot where she is in power, she knows what's going on. Because before, like, because it starts and the separation has already begun, we only have their word for it. We don't know if he behaved the way that she says he does, although I suspect that he mostly did. Like, I think the truth lies somewhere in the middle. I have a feeling that everything that both of them said is true. Like, so much of his perception. What is that line? She has this amazing line that feels like something that maybe came out of therapy. It's towards the end of their huge fight. That she was talking about whether or not they'd move to LA. She said, "Oh my God, your personality has merged with your selfishness."
Yeah, oh my God, yes.
It has merged with your selfishness so much that you don't even realize it's selfishness anymore. It can't even occur to him that other people have needs that are not being satisfied as long as his are being satisfied.
Like him being merged with his own selfishness and him also loving all the most difficult parts of parenting. And that, like, that wonderful bit of selflessness. Those two things coexist in people that we know and care about. No one is a cartoon character the way Lauren Dern and Ray Liotta are.
Right.
Everyone has this, like, this horrible side to them. Yeah. That only gets exposed when they are uncomfortably close to somebody else.
Yeah, well, you have to be close, but somebody has to call you out on it, too.
Yeah, there's a huge, like, Charlie intends to be a great person. That's what he sees in himself. That's what he wants to be. That's what he wants to portray.
Not just a great person, but a great man.
Oh, yes.
He wants to be one of the great men of the theater scene, right? He wants to be a towering figure.
You are absolutely correct. But in focusing on wanting to be that and sort of ticking boxes that will get him there, he completely ignores his impact on others.
Yeah.
Which is this, like, this weird kind of, because part of being a great man is understanding your impact on other people.
Right.
But he misses the point that other people get to decide, and he doesn't.
Right.
I don't know how you write these characters without having been one and dated the other.
So let's talk about Noah Baumbach and being a little autobiographical. So his first feature is Kicking and Screaming, which kind of was the indie darling of 1995, or at least one of them. His next big outing as a director isn't until 2005, and it's The Squid and the Whale, which is like a bluntly autobiographical, lightly fictionalized take on his parents' divorce. That movie is a hard fucking watch. Like, it's like, what if Marriage Story without all the warmth and niceness?
Yeah, I think you once told me to watch that, and I ignored you. And I should probably watch it.
Yeah, it's hard. It's got a really young Jesse Eisenberg in the Baumbach role. Jeff Daniels and Laura Linney play his parents. It's much less sympathetic to its characters. Like, it is very judgmental of them, and it doesn't often balance out their uglier sides with their warmer sides. So I'm sure, you know, he had a unique perspective from watching his parents divorce, but God, it gets ugly in that movie. Marriage Story is largely assumed to be Baumbach processing his divorce from actress Jennifer Jason Leigh. They were a New York family, and then they had a divorce and a custody battle. I don't want to go any further than that because I'm not particularly interested in gossip. Like, it's their personal lives, whether or not he puts it on screen. But yeah, so it's definitely lived in. It comes from somebody who experienced that kind of, like, it's just awful. It hurts so much. I love the characters so much. And when they start saying shitty things to each other, it's the two scenes back to back. It's the first courtroom scene when Charlie and Nicole are basically silent the whole time. And it's just the lawyers, Ray Liotta and Laura Dern, just lobbing bombs back and forth. Like, and it's like a 90s TV legal drama. Like, they're those kind of lawyers. They have every barb ready to go. You know, they're never at a loss for words.
Yep.
Did you get all misty? Because the thing that hits me that wouldn't hit you is the dad stuff. The dad stuff with custody is so palpable, and so it's such a tangible terror. Like, I have a very good marriage, but like, if things went badly and we had to fight over custody, like, I would just be, it would utterly destroy me.
Yes, it would. Yes. And I think that we can all kind of understand on a certain level. We don't specifically feel it the way that that parents do, but it hurts. It hurts to watch, and it hurts, like, having been, you know, somebody's son, to, you know, the idea of these people that you love just hating each other or seeming to.
Yeah.
They do a really good job, and it's pretty explicit in the movie that they do a good job of insulating Henry from everything.
Yeah, he doesn't seem to have any sense of the animosity, right? Like, he's not quite a pawn, but it doesn't seem like they're like, oh my God, your dad's such an asshole and your mom's being such a bitch about this. Like, we don't get any sense of that. They're both trying to do right by him.
I think that the thing that, obviously, I was set off by their fight. The courtroom fight is painful, and yeah, you can see how much it hurts both of them, but it's these cartoon characters that are just wielding information that may or may not have been explicitly said could be used in court.
Oh, I think it was. Because neither one of them is ever surprised when any of it comes out. It's not like either one of them, like, they might flinch, but it's not like, oh, how dare she repeat that? That was in confidence. Like, they both know that this is all going to come out.
I suppose. And I guess Charlie is definitely aware because he went to Ray Liotta.
Right. He went to the shark.
And Nicole might be aware because this is a story of her actually becoming who she wants to be.
Right.
Charlie never doesn't get there. We can assume he gets there in 5 or 10 years, but he's not mature Charlie in this movie.
I wanna come back to that thought. Finish up what you want to say, but I want to come back to that because that ties into some things I think about the mise en scène. The aesthetic of the movie.
You're gonna whatever the fuck mise-en-scene is.
Mise-en-scene.
We're gonna have to talk about that in a second, but I just...
Well, we will.
So, like, after that, then she comes over and there's the big throwdown battle. Where, despite Charlie, he's menacing in frame physically because he's so huge. But I don't think there were maybe one or two points, because I've been trained as a movie watcher to expect violence from large men who are angry.
Right.
That I maybe flinched a little bit, but I don't think that was ever a real concern. I was just torn apart by how badly they were tearing each other apart.
Yeah. And saying such awful things to hurt each other that they knew would hurt the other person. Like, they said it because I want to hurt you. And there is, at the very least, a kernel of truth. But really, I'm saying it because I want to hurt you.
And it's summed up explicitly in the lines of the song that Charlie karaoke's at the end of the movie.
Yeah.
Love me too much, hurt me too much, hurt me too deep, or whatever it is.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what it is. Like, they are too close, and therefore they will hurt each other the most. And they tear each other down.
Yeah.
So then you get to the part where the observer comes to observe Charlie and Henry in the house.
Right. Another bizarre, farcical scene in the movie. It's not laugh out loud funny, but it is extremely awkward. And Martha Kelly, who plays the evaluator, has such a quiet, like, I don't know if it's just how this woman is or if it's a professional affect that she wants to put on to appear neutral while observing them. But she is so dead. Like, she's just, like, dead inside and dead outside and almost no reactions to anything. Like, she plays that so, so perfectly.
I think it's kind of both. I've never had to go through a divorce, but I would imagine that if you're a person in that role, you don't get to really interact on a friendly level with the people that you are observing. My instinct would likely be exactly Charlie's, which is to, like, try and make small talk and make jokes and tell anecdotes.
Because it's another person in a room with you.
And be charming, because he knows that he's charming. But then Henry mentions the knife thing.
The knife thing, yeah.
We've seen Charlie fidget with the knife the whole movie. And we don't really know the significance of the knife until this moment. And we realize that it's a thing that Nicole got him as a gift.
Yeah. And something that he entertains his kid with some kind of dumb gag, right? Where he pretends to cut his arm but pulls the blade back.
Except then he demonstrates it for her and actually cuts himself.
My audience shrieked when he did that. And it's so subtle. You see him just like in the act of moving his arm, you see the red streak. Yep. On the side of his forearm, and then it's gone again, and he hasn't even realized it. The audience absolutely shrieked like it was a jump scare. It was amazing.
Well, because it is. You kind of expect him to be in control. He's obviously feeling a little bit more comfortable at that moment that he's willing to tell that story.
Yeah.
It lays bare exactly how terrified he is of losing his son, how completely not in control of his life he is, and how completely in denial of both of those things that he is. He keeps telling her that he's fine. Everything's fine. And then she leaves. And the whole time I'm watching him try and clean this wound and dress it. And I've cut myself pretty badly recently trying to repair the dryer downstairs. And also during harvest, I got hit pretty hard. And I'm watching him do this. And I'm like, dude, you're doing everything wrong.
Yeah, he's washing it and trying to use a couple of band-aids to hold it together. For a man who is described very early on in the movie as being extremely self-sufficient, he literally like collapses on top of himself while trying to avoid bleeding out with paper towels and band-aids.
Well, right, and that's the other, like, Nicole describes him as self-sufficient.
Yeah.
But then he talks about how she cuts their hair.
Right.
It's very clear that no, he's not self-sufficient.
Just because you don't cut your own hair doesn't mean you're not self-sufficient. Like, maybe she does a good job. He clearly likes the way she does it.
I think what it speaks to is no one is actually self-sufficient.
Right, exactly.
We rely on other people to take care of us in certain ways. And when you have a wound, particularly on one of your arms, where you can't have both hands to help dress it, that's a point in time when you need somebody else's help.
But he's desperate to avoid looking like an idiot who's not responsible enough to be a single parent.
Right.
I was thinking about the look of the movie and the look of the production design. And the production design is just like, is the whole art department, right? It's the look of anything that goes in front of the movie. So production design is set decoration, but also the construction of sets. It's practical or it's functional, but it's also about art. Costuming falls a little bit under production design. Like, it's all mise-en-scene.
Mise-en-scene is a thing that I've heard you say in a really exaggerated accent for years, and I don't actually know what it is or where it comes from or even how to spell it.
So it is French. Mise-en-scene, M-I-S-E, en, scene, which is just scene with a accent over one of the E's. And it is literally the arrangement of scenery and stage properties in a play or in a movie. It is the arrangement of all of the elements that are in front of the camera. And in this movie, the thing I kept noticing so much is how neutral so many of the backgrounds are. The walls are white or off-white or eggshell or cream, or it's just everything is white or light backgrounds that oftentimes have earthy accents or wood tones. I noticed it especially in the Charlie scenes, like in his apartment, right? Like before he decorates. It is intentionally disinteresting. It wants to underline, I think, the banality of their experience. It's so everyday for everybody else and for the two of them, like this is a major defining moment in their lives. And then we can get a little bit into spoilery territory, but you were talking earlier about how, like, Nicole basically begins the movie deciding to grow and evolve, and Charlie never becomes, like, a fuller version of himself. And I think the last shot at the very end is the whole last scene at the very end, which is, like, they've signed the divorce papers. Clearly, like, he is now settling in L.A. They're resolving. It seems like they're amicable. It's Halloween night. And Nicole has said, you know, he's pretty tired. Why don't you take Henry for the night, even though it's my night? And they have this really sweet moment. And as she and her family drive off to go do Halloween stuff, and Charlie is loading Henry into the car, it is the most colorful shot in the whole movie.
Yeah.
Even though it's this incredibly, like, banal setting, which is, like a wealthy, you know, L.A. suburb, essentially. But there's so much color, and Charlie has finally... He has accepted mundanity and banality in his life by moving to a place where he doesn't want to be, but he has found fullness and richness in his life. He's made concessions. He has the relationship with his child that he wants. He's able to think beyond himself. Like that, and again, spoilers for the end of the movie, but that, like, million-dollar shot on Scarlett when Charlie tells Nicole that, oh, you know what, I took up a residency at...
UCLA. He took up a residency at what...
It was UCLA.
Yeah, it was UCLA, but he named a specific theater.
Yeah, and he's going to direct a couple of plays, and the look on her face says a million things, but especially, like, God, why couldn't you do that a year ago? Like, we could have avoided all of this if you could have just done that before. But, like, he's made concessions, and then he's finally in a place. And I think all of that is tied in with this look, which is so much about bland white rooms.
Do you think that that's because you started that whole sentence there with, or that whole paragraph or whatever, I blacked out because you're so fucking long-winded, with my assertion that Charlie never grows into adult Charlie.
Yeah.
Do you think that that's him growing into adult Charlie?
I think it's a huge step for him.
Yeah,
I think it's him making concessions and seeing beyond himself. Yeah. He's not 100% there, but he's made enormous progress.
For me, that end scene is him finally being at the place in his life that Nicole is right after she meets with Laura Dern.
Interesting.
Like, the acceptance that growth needs to happen, and he needs to, like, he knows what he needs to become and has set his foot along that path. He's definitely not there. Because, like, she's the one that, like, looks at him with Henry in his arms, and the kid is tired, and she offers the extra night because he's made all of these concessions. Like, she can see that he's becoming that, but he's still kind of dependent.
Yeah.
And then her like, tying his shoe at the very end is exactly that.
Do you think that's part of a recognition of his lack of self-sufficiency? I felt that was more just, like, a sweet grace note. Like, they still have some kind of relationship. I guess you're right. I guess it's he still needs her for things, right?
Everyone needs everyone for things. No one is fully self-sufficient.
Right. You can't treat a cut on your arm.
You can't treat a cut on your arm. Like, every libertarian in the whole world wants you to believe that it's self-reliance and everything will be golden after that. But that's not true. We live in a society. We have evolved to be social creatures.
Right.
We need other people.
We need each other. I need you, Jamie. And you need me.
I'll give it up.
Yeah.
I need you too, Scott.
Give it up. Pompous
ass. I am. Let's talk about wine.
Before we move on to the wine, I want to hit you with one thing.
Yeah.
What pretentious sommelier wine adjectives would you use to describe Marriage Story?
First of all, sommeliers are not pretentious. We are communicators. I'm not even going to do this bit. Sommeliers are terrible. We suck. Don't listen to us. Some terms that I would use to describe this movie, honestly. So, funny enough, I have used the word aching to describe wine before.
Really?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
What does that mean in a wine? What is aching in a wine?
It doesn't mean anything. Let's be very clear here.
It doesn't mean anything. It's all bullshit, right? It's all a scam.
There are very technical terms that we use with each other to describe wine that sound really inaccessible because it's sort of a technical dialogue between people who've devoted their life to this fucking fermented grape juice. But when we're at tables or when we're in a wine shop or when we're trying to deal with the general public, the best thing that we can do is convey emotion.
Yeah.
Because that's a really great sales technique. And that's really that's what any psalm does. So using the word aching to describe something, I would not describe the wine that we're currently drinking as aching. The movie in pretentious wine terms, I would describe as flowing. I would describe as with an impression of sweetness while still remaining totally dry. And I would describe it as rich is the big one. Like if this movie were a meal, it would be a full 5-course fatty meal. Transitioning into this wine.
Yeah, tell me about the wine.
So I don't even know where to start exactly, but let's dive in to the place, because I one of the romantic notions about wine is the idea of terroir, which is that you can taste where a wine comes from. So Umbria is central Italy. It is landlocked, which is sort of not unique, but unusual among Italian wine areas. Normally they have some significant influence of the sea, and Umbria still does. So it's on one side, on the west side, it's bordered by the Apennine Mountains. And then there are sort of a series of valleys that lead out to the Tyrrhenian Sea. So there is sea breeze that makes its way into Umbria. Umbria is traditionally, for thousands of years...
Pump the brakes. What does that mean? What does sea breeze mean? What does that do to my appreciation of the wine?
It affects the climate is the baseline, and that can happen in a number of different ways depending on where you are. But in this case, it brings humidity and also cooler air, because Umbria is a pretty hot area of Italy.
And what does that do?
What does
cooler air and humidity?
Cooling influence is going to allow you to preserve acidity. In a very, very basic way, think of heat as a way to increase sugar content, which will then increase alcohol content. Cooling effects as a way to preserve acidity. That's a very basic, unnuanced way to look at it. So you've got this area that's landlocked, that has historically been agrarian, even back to the days of like the early Etruscans, who were frequent enemies of the Umbri people. The Etruscans built cities and the Umbri people really didn't. They built farms and small areas to congregate and foster trade. Nothing like an Etruscan city and then later a Roman city. That agrarian mindset persisted until the 19th century, when a steel mill was installed in Umbria. Steel mill was installed there because of proximity to a waterfall, the Marmore waterfall, but that was then bombed to oblivion in World War II, as Umbria ended up being sort of a big front between the Allies and the Axis forces.
Fascinating.
Yeah. Next fun fact is that since World War II, Umbria has been a stronghold of the socialist movement in Italy. Right up until the 2019 election, when Donatella Tese won the presidency. She's the president of Umbria now, and she is a member of the Lega Nord, which is a political party that is known for being right-wing, regionalist, Euroskeptic, and anti-immigration.
Well, I mean, that's only one part of the world. That sounds bad, but at least that's not happening everywhere in the Western, world right now, and on top of everywhere else. Thank God this is the only place where right-wing authoritarianism is on the rise.
Yeah, I personally am thankful that it is unique to Umbria that a populist right-wing leader would sort of come to supplant progressive thought.
That would never happen here. is what we're saying.
It would never, ever in the United States, and honestly never anywhere else.
Right. Tell me about, so we've talked about the region. Tell me about these grapes. So this is a blend, right?
Hold on. I have one more fun fact about Umbria that's just fun.
Is it about Nazis?
Only a little bit.
Because you talked a lot about right-wing people, and none of those were fun facts.
It's only a little bit about Nazis.
God damn it!
So the
high... I smell the cork just to spite you here.
That's not what civilized people do. We don't smell corks.
We don't smell corks.
The highest production of wine that comes from Umbria is from an appellation called Orvieto. And Orvieto is a white wine. It's pretty simple. It's not particularly highly regarded. It can sometimes be great. The fun thing is that Orvieto was the wine that was used by Dr. Enrico Fermi to toast the Manhattan Project's first successful nuclear reaction.
What?
So
that's good and also terrible. Yeah. Thanks.
I'm here for the fun nice. Facts. I got you.
You got all that end of the world shit covered.
Orvieto is like right next door to Montefalco. And Montefalco is higher elevation. Montefalco, as I said in the beginning, is sort of like a hill. It's almost one single hill. The grape that is most famous from this area is Sagrantino. If you ever see a bottle that says Montefalco, but it says like Montefalco Sagrantino, it's likely pretty expensive. And if it's anything less than 10 years old, you need to cellar it for another 10 years. There's like super massive, extracted, tannic, high acid, like really, really aggressive wines. Because it's this big, powerful grape from this hot, hot climate.
And when you say aggressive, what is an aggressive wine? Let's assume, hypothetically, that I don't know anything about wine. Hypothetically,
yeah.
And that I don't know what an aggressive wine is.
So, for me, aggressive begins with tannin and acid. So, tannin is the thing that dries your mouth out, like an oversteeped black tea. And acid is the thing that produces saliva. It's that tart feeling. It's basically, if you were to squeeze lemon juice into your mouth, that is high acid. And the opposite of that would be like a cream sauce, which has no discernible acid at all. So a very high acid wine, much like just raw unadulterated lemon juice, is kind of unpleasant and difficult for your palate to deal with. Similarly, a completely oversteeped black tea is just going to dry your mouth out and kind of hurt and be really astringent. So when I say aggressive, those are the first two things. But then the next thing is like concentration of flavor. How much flavor is there in this wine? And that can be a product of ripeness. That can be a product of extraction. But it's like it's sort of the total volume of flavor, if that makes sense.
I think it does.
Now, Montefalco Rosso is sort of the step down from Sagrantino Montefalco. These wines are meant to be drunk a little bit younger. They're meant to be a little bit less ageable. They're meant to be more approachable. And they are Sangiovese based rather than being Sagrantino based.
All right. So tell me about the Sangiovese. Is that offensive? Is it offensive if I do an Italian accent?
No.
I shouldn't do Italian accents,
you
right?
You can do an Italian accent. Sangiovese.
Sangiovese. Winefolly.com.
Oh, Jesus.
Can you, James, name for me the five primary flavors that Winefolly says are the primary flavors of Sangiovese?
All right. Let's go ahead and give this a guess. Do we have raspberry on there?
Here, just give me your five. I'm gonna write them down, and then I'll tell you.
All right. So for me, Sangiovese is red or Bing cherry, raspberry, strawberry, sometimes cranberry, and then tomato leaf is the bit, or like tomato leaf, oregano, sage, like something herbal. Yeah, those are, if I had to condense it, it would be fruit first, followed by this herbal thing, and then we could talk about earth as like a tertiary characteristic.
And what would that earth be like? How would you, is it just, do you just say earthy, or do you say,
no,
you
I say like dirt? Specifically like almost like dried, like crumbly clay is sort of the thing that I associate with Sangiovese.
All right. So winefolly.com. We've got cherry on the board.
Okay.
We've got roasted tomato, not tomato leaf.
Bullshit.
We've got oregano.
Okay.
But then we've got sweet balsamic and espresso. We do not have raspberry, cranberry, but we do have your red cherry, something from the tomato plant, and oregano. So you're 3 for 5.
I don't disagree with that list as much as I disagreed with the Sauvignon Blanc list.
Right, you were pretty cranky about that one.
It was bullshit. This one, balsamic is definitely a thing that a lot of people use as an indicator for Sangiovese. It's never been a particular thing for me, but I get it. Hmm. Flavor is very personal. You know, we all taste from our own memory.
Can I tell you what I felt about the wine? Because I took notes.
Yeah, why don't we start with what you thought about the wine, and then I'll tell you what actually the wine is.
So I opened this last night. I asked Jamie for very specific instructions. Should I open it? Should I aerate it? Should I decant it? Should I just let it breathe for an hour? And his response was, I believe, bitch, just pour it in a glass. So I did that. This bitch just poured it in a glass. My first pour, no breathing, no nothing. My immediate thought was, this tastes and smells like every red wine I've ever had. First impression. Thought it was very dry. I thought it was spicy. It was a little spicy. Not heat, but like there was some kind of spice on the end. Tannins.
What kind of spice?
Astringency.
What's the spice? Is it clove? Is it allspice? Is it like a baking spice? Or is it like a cayenne pepper or like a chili flakes or...
I don't know. Somewhere between spicy and zingy. Like a raw onion is zingy. I was trying to explain this to my wife last night. That for me, like when I smell or when I taste a wine, it's like I can tell that I am not perceiving everything that is there. You know, it's like I visualize when I take a sniff, like the nostril is really only getting like 20% of what's going, passing through.
Right, I get that.
I had a second glass about an hour later, and I felt that it opened up, and I believe I detected on the nose, but also on the palate, hints of leather. Did I detect leather?
Yeah.
I detected leather?
I mean, I do. That would have been like my next flavor point for Sangiovese. Would have been leather.
My wife had some wife notes here. This is a recurring segment called Wife Takes on the wine. She felt that there was cocoa on the nose and cocoa late on the palate. And she thought it was like burnt brownie edges is how specifically she was. And then she wrote a word that she didn't think I'd be able to spell. And I could have, but I can't pronounce it. Petrichor? Petrichor?
Petrichor, yeah.
What is that?
Petrichor is this. You ever like walk outside right as it begins to rain?
Yes.
That is a distinctive smell. Like, yes. Right at the very beginning.
The beginning of rain.
As the earth is sort of like...
Yeah.
You're just starting to get a little bit of water on the ground, and the earth, yeah, like, aerosolizes whatever aromas are right at the surface. That's petrichor.
Huh.
There's a wine from California that's called petrichor, and it's fucking good.
But wait, is petrichor a chemical, or is it just a way that we describe something?
Petrichor is the word for that smell.
For that smell.
It's not, okay, a chemical. It's just the word. I don't know that anyone has identified what the chemicals are, but across the board, humans recognize the smell just as it begins to rain.
All right, so tell me what is actually going on in the flavor and scental profile of this wine.
First of all, I think that there is no petrichor at all going on in this wine. I think your wife is...
Oh, shit.
Has missed the boat on that one.
Are you going to call her out on the air? All right.
On the
good
air.
You're going to get poisoned whenever it is, we can have a party again.
Cocoa and burnt brownie ends, absolutely. That's totally here. And we're going to talk about exactly, okay, where I think that is from in just a second. But let's talk just briefly about Montefalco Rosso and this wine specifically, technically. Then we'll talk about what I think the wine tastes like, very briefly, because I really do hate tasting notes. And then we'll talk a little bit about Arnaldo Capri, the producer. So, Montefalco Rosso is Sangiovese-based. It's required to be, I think, between 60 and 80% Sangiovese, with between 20 and 40% Sagrantino, and I think it allows something like 15% of other acceptable varieties for Umbria. That's what they say in Italy, when it can be kind of whatever you want. So this particular wine is 70% Sangiovese, 30% Sagrantino, 15% Merlot. It undergoes a 15-day fermentation in stainless steel done with indigenous yeasts. It's aged 12 months in barrel, and it doesn't, on the website or on any tech sheet I could find, say whether it is new or used oak, just that it's French oak. It's 14.5% alcohol by volume. The average age of the vines are 25 years. It is on limestone and clay soil at approximately, on average, 700 feet above sea level. So what all this adds up to for me, we've got a really fast, hot fermentation. 15 days is not a huge amount of time. It's not like super, super fast, but I would guess that the temperatures are up there. And that is going to account for a lot of the fruit character that we've got in this wine. I think if this wine were allowed to go really slow and low, this would be a very, very earthy wine that would require long, long aging. And the hotter fermentation sort of allows it to be what it is, which is really pleasant. Do I think it'll age? Absolutely. Am I happy to drink it now? Also, yes. It gets 12 months in barrel. I think that there's new oak. I don't think it's 100% new oak. I think it's some like lower, maybe 30%, something like that. But that accounts for the cocoa notes. That I think accounts for whatever spice you're picking up, because I get star anise, clove, vanilla, allspice. It tastes like this wine saw new French oak.
Is it?
What?
Is it preferable to use new oak? Is new oak better, or is it just like it's...
You use what you use to achieve a certain effect. And there are some people who would argue that using new oak is always the best way. And there are some people who would tell you that using old or no oak is always the best way. And I have found that most people who tell you that something is always the best way in winemaking are in some meaningful way full of shit.
Or they have an agenda.
There isn't... Hard and fast rules are really hard to find. Like, there are questions of ethos, for sure, and there are questions of, you know, house style, but to say that all wine should have new French oak on it is just stupid. Or even that all of a particular varietal.
Does it seem appropriate to compare those types of comments and arguments about use of new oak? Does that feel even remotely analogous to, I don't know how much you're familiar with the debate in the film world about, which has been all hyped up and blown out of proportion, but about 35 millimeter versus digital. Like, there are 35 millimeter purists who say you have to shoot on film and digital can never replicate what film can do. And then you have people who are like, oh, but digital can do so many things that 35 can't do. And then there's kind of people in the middle who, like, the director or the cinematographer of this movie, Robbie Ryan, was very frank in one of the interviews I read where he's like, we could have achieved this look digitally.
I'm just going to go ahead and answer your question.
Yes, answer the question.
I think that it's very analogous. And I think that it's often where I land in the wine world is sort of in the middle, which is very, very weird for me because like on the political spectrum, I'm extremely not in the middle. But when it comes to wine and also frequently movies, people who have these firm ideas of the way a thing should be, that just means that you have a particular taste.
Yeah, like it's a tool, right? These are all tools in the toolkit.
Exactly. So whether it's 35 or digital, I've seen plenty of great movies on both. And I've drunk plenty of great wines that have used a ton of oak and plenty of great wines that have used none. And I've drunk plenty of great wines that have been inoculated and plenty that are native ferments. We can go on and extrapolate that analogy, but they're all tools. And if you say that using a particular tool makes a bad result or a demonstrably less good result, you either have an agenda or you're a fucking douchebag. That's my hot take on that situation.
Hot takes. In advocating for openness in the toolkit, Jamie is being an absolutist and saying that if you act in a certain way, you must be a douchebag.
Well, you know, I also have to be who I am.
Yeah.
So that's the way that is. So, all right. So speaking of hot, this wine is pretty hot. It's labeled at 14.5% alcohol. And when you hear me say hot, what I mean is high alcohol. And this wine wears it well. It doesn't feel aggressively alcoholic, but you can tell, you know, when you breathe out after you've taken a sip, it's like there's a bunch of alcohol. That's because these vines get super, super duper ripe because it's hot. These are south facing hillsides. So they get a lot of sunshine and they've got a long growing season and it's relatively dry. And so they develop a lot of sugars while they develop a lot of flavors. The average age of the vines is 25 years old. That's notable just because this is sort of an entry-level bottling, and vines of that age typically go into a higher-end bottling. And this really just speaks to the overall superlative quality that Capri brings to the table. It's an estate that has established itself as one of the two best estates in the region. Speaking of that, the other one is Paolo Bea, which is a producer that's much more popular sort of in my wine circles because they take the opposite approach. Paolo Bea is much more on the natural side of things, despite the fact that Capri advocates sustainability and cover crops and biodiversity in the vineyards and indigenous fermentation. They still have a highly technical sort of lab-driven wine team that is based more on analysis than feeling. And Paolo Bea is of the more romantic, like the wine will do what it does and we will, when it's ready, bottle it.
So they're more intuitive. It's an art, not a science for them.
Yeah, I think that's the main difference because, and also the difference between new oak and no oak. Paolo Bea will use old oak that doesn't impart flavor. It just allows some oxygen to integrate. Capri will use new oak. And that's a major dividing line in whatever wine people call traditionalist versus modern. But I think the other thing is the sort of analytical, like it's very important for Capri to always taste like what we have in our glass right now. But it would not be uncommon if we got two bottles of Paolo Bea that one would taste remarkably different than the other. The estate was started in 1971 by a guy named Arnaldo Capri, and he bought 12 and a half acres. And now his son, Marco, who took over in 88, has expanded to 300-something acres with like 200-something that are fully in production. So like a big, big increase. And that's, Arnaldo was a textiles entrepreneur. So this is a classic kind of, money comes to the agrarian town and decides to be the champion for the traditional grape varietal, Sagrantino, but also for the local economy. And I think Capri has done a lot of good, but also it's a little self-serving. You know, they're wealthy people in a way that a lot of the people in the area aren't, as evidenced by their previous socialist leanings and now their aggressive populist leanings. I think they're doing everything right, which is why I love to drink these wines and to buy them. They are focused on vineyard biodiversity, limited pesticides, monitoring their carbon footprint. Marco, the guy who's running the estate now, is an active proponent internationally and locally of the wines of Umbria. Whereas Paolo Bea has sort of gotten noticed just by doing the things that they have done for centuries. It's sort of an interesting dichotomy.
Do we like this wine? Do we have strong feelings about it? You seem pretty keen on it, right? I guess the question is, do I like this wine?
I like it. It's not the kind of wine that I drink every day because it's full bodied. There's more oak than I typically enjoy on a wine just for sipping. There's a lot of tannin.
I'm pretty sure there's a lot of tannin.
My teeth hurt a little bit. There's a lot of
tannin. Yeah, okay. That's a good way to describe that. My teeth hurt. My mouth feels like dehydrated, like after you just had a long dental procedure before they give you the Mr. Thirsty. That's what my child's pediatric dentist calls it.
This is a wine that is meant to be drunk with food, as many Italian wines are. So if you had a nice like cut of steak with this wine, you'd probably be a happier camper than just sitting here drinking it. It's not a cocktail wine. It's not a thing that we just want to down a bottle of.
And yet, here we are.
I do like it, but it's not the style that I normally go for.
Would we describe this as a big red? You have described my wine taste in the past as leaning towards big reds. This is one of them?
Yep.
Yeah.
But it differs from your typical wine taste in that it is so sharply tannic.
Right.
There's no softness here. They tried to give you a little softness, a little pillow of 15% Merlot, but it's not enough. When you have Sangiovese that's this ripe and 30% Sagrantino, which is such a bruiser, 15% Merlot kind of gets lost in the mix.
Mm. Yeah. Hurts your teeth.
Yep. It's a little painful. One might say aching.
Not unlike Marriage Story. Interesting.
That's right.
Yeah, is that hurts your teeth? Yeah, like it's
So do you like the wine or not, motherfucker?
I think so. I still largely, and this is as much a reflection on me as it is on the wine, probably more me than the wine. It still tastes like basically every red wine I've ever had, which like
that's thank you for bringing that back up. I wanted to address that. That's a quality of Italian red wine on this level that can be both a feature and a bug. So the most famous appellations or the wines that have that command the biggest price, wines like Barolo and Barbaresco and Sagrantino di Montefalco and Bulgari Rosso and the whole Super Tuscan situation, all of those
Super
wines,
Tuscans.
We're not going to go there. We're not going to talk about what a Super Tuscan is. That's for another episode.
Super Tuscans.
You better stop it.
All right, fine.
All of those wines have counterparts that are less expensive from younger vines, from less interesting vineyards, and sometimes from different grapes that are regarded less highly. Those include Barbera and Dolcetto from Piedmont. They include Montefalco Rosso and the Sangioveses thereof. Also, like Maremma Toscana, like the lower level Sangiovese appellations of the Tuscan coast. And those wines all kind of taste, they have this like red wine taste. They just taste like what red wine tastes like.
So this was not me being self-denigrating. This was an extremely perceptive note that I had here, that it tastes like red wine.
Yeah, and I think in this case it's a feature rather than a bug.
Yeah. It is tasty, but it's not outlandish in a way that like I will probably not remember this wine particularly well, which is again probably part of my mechanism, right? My palate. My schnuffer and my palate are just not that precise. They're not detecting things. Not just that my wife was trying to give me credit last night. And saying, well, you probably just don't have the vocabulary. Like, no, I'm literally not detecting things. Like, I wasn't getting anything other than red wine on the nose until the second glass an hour later. And I was like, oh, leather. I think this is leather. This is the first time I've detected leather. Maybe Jamie's not just making this shit up.
Well, I do think that there are things that you could have detected other than red wine. I will agree with your assessment that this wine tastes like red wine. And sort of the function here
it tastes like
is
red wine.
Is just to have a good red wine that tastes good with food and you don't kind of have to think about it that much. And what they're hoping is that you will have at some point had the Montefalco Sagrantino, which is singular and doesn't taste like just red wine. It is its own thing and distinctive to the place. And anytime you open up a bottle of the Montefalco Rosso, you'll be reminded of the higher end.
Hmm. I guess then the last question is, does this pairing work? Do you think this is paired well to Marriage Story? I don't know. At one point last night, before I had my Eureka moment and detected leather, which I'm so very proud of, we'll be making up t-shirts later on to commemorate the moment. But I initially felt that it was not, and then later on I realized that I don't know. I don't know that I can parse that. Do you feel like it's a good pairing? Because you picked this having not seen the movie.
Yeah, so it's hard for a number of reasons, obviously. And I think you not knowing just kind of proves that it doesn't work. Because if it works, then you kind of know. Or at least that's what I think of when I think of wine and food pairing. And this wine and film pairing is a lot more abstract, right? Like it's
entirely abstract.
Wine and food
pairing. Like it's 100% abstract, right?
Yeah. Wine and food pairing is a little bit abstract, but also plenty of it chemically happens in your mouth.
Right.
when you're talking about wine and music or wine and movies, it's entirely abstract and you're just trying to make justifications or talk about context or what.
And the ache, the aching. Do I think Marriage Story makes my teeth hurt? I don't know about that, but it hurts. It hurts in a pleasant way. This is the thing that, like, whenever I try and recommend that movie to people, like, oh, isn't that a big weepy? I'm like, oh, yeah, I sobbed in front of 450 people and then went running out of the theater and tried to find my office where I could go cry quietly where no one would bother me. It's a big, hard, painful movie, but I feel it's like life-affirming. The pain that the movie inflicts upon you or that you participate in, like, I feel seen. I feel less alone because they're so human and I love those characters so much. And you just feel, you feel empathy for them so completely, even when they're being shits or when they're being bastards. Like, do you find the tooth-hurtingness of the tannins of this wine to be, is it pleasant or is that just like something we have to deal with when we have highly tannic wines?
I mean, it's nice when you have food to go with it. And I think that if this movie were, if there was suspense involved.
Right.
That it might match up. That sort of like, that pain on your palate might match up with your body clenching. But that's not what this movie does. This movie, it inflicts its pain on you in a very sweet way. It's not forceful. You have to give it your attention in order to be hurt by it. And then the pain that it causes you to think about yourself and your own life. This wine sort of inflicts itself upon you in a way that a thriller or a suspense film would. I don't think that this pairing is good. I thought that this movie would be more forceful. You said aching and balanced, and I took that to mean that I needed something big to sort of counter it. But I think that this movie requires something softer and more subtle. As I watched it the first time, I was like, I thought to myself, this pairing doesn't work. Should I text Scott and tell him to not open this bottle and we'll switch it? And I'm glad we didn't, because we can talk about pairings just simply not working. But for this movie, I think I would lean towards a white wine.
I was wondering just like aesthetically, like when I was watching it last night and thinking about how much of the movie is light, neutral, like white rooms, essentially, like it, just aesthetically, does it make sense to have a pairing that is of a brighter color or that is like, would you pair to a white wine just because the movie looks like that?
I would lean away from like actual color, like visual differences, but the effect that the palette has on the tone and the effect, like the tone of a white wine that might be brighter and more fruit driven, or might even have a little bit of residual sugar to it, like a Vouvray or something, give you a little bit of that sweet sorrow that this movie kind of begs for.
Yeah.
I think even something older, like an older Mosel Valley Riesling, something with some oxidation that might feel a little bit like, you know, it's starting to get more caramel and toffee and like darker undertones while still being its bright fruity self, might be a better pair for this wine or for this movie.
Just occurred to me, talking about the color, is that between this recording and our previous test recording that shall never be made public to the light of day, that movie has a very red color palette. There is a lot of like thematically important reds that are all over the color presentation of that film. And you picked a white wine. Yeah. And then this movie, which is like super white, neutral fucking eggshell, you picked a big honking red wine.
Well, I mean, why don't you start giving me some color indications in your descriptions, and then we can see if that works out.
We can definitely do color. What else would be helpful for you? Because this is, for however long we're doing this, this is going to be a weird and like, it is somehow less intuitive for us to be doing this than it is for a listener, I would imagine. So like, what else will help you make pairings that are maybe more on the mark?
I've spent my whole career pairing wine with food. it took a long time for that to become intuitive, and then it did. And then it took a long time for that to break from intuition and be able to articulate actually why these pairings work. And now I'm doing that
right
all the fuck over again. So let's baby step it. Let's start with, we'll keep the baseline adjectives that you've been doing, but like give me color. And we'll see if that works.
Okay. I enjoyed the wine. My perceptions being what they are, I can't speak to it in full. I don't know if it's a good pairing or not, but it was interesting, and I enjoyed it more at the end of the movie than I did at when I first opened up the bottle.
I think this wine pairs. This wine pairs best with the fight scene, when Charlie and Nicole sure are. That's when this wine shines. That's when you want to.
That's when I finished my glass.
You want a stress drink because mom and dad are fighting.
And it hurts your teeth, and it's dry, and it's biting, and it is unpleasant. But still, like, it looks great, and it sounds great, and it's still, like, aesthetically pleasing to experience.
Sure is.
Well, Marriage Story is currently available on the Netflix. It's one of those quote-unquote Netflix original films. That's the only place you can watch it. There's also a Criterion Collection Blu-ray and DVD that's out that I'm sure are exceptional. But check it out on Netflix and hit me up if you want to talk about it. If you listen to the episode and have seen the movie or end up watching it, let me know what your thoughts are. We'll plug all of our social handles at the end of the episode.
Arnaldo Capri wines, just broadly, are imported and distributed by Wilson Daniels. So if you're a wine buyer, you can contact your local Wilson Daniels rep and get them. And if you are a regular citizen, you can find them shipped to most states by Crush Wine Company out of New York City. That would be crushwineco.com.
Crushwineco.com.
Right.
But we are both Pennsylvania residents, and we were able to get this from, like, for example, if you live in PA, which happens to be a particularly difficult state to get wine and alcohol in, this was readily available for us on the PA State Store website.
No, this was Crush. This was Crush Wine.
You had to order this from Crush? I thought you ordered I thought you ordered the whole case from. So everything came from Crush.
There we go. I like to avoid using the PLCB stores at all.
Costs. You fucking hate them.
They're terrible. They're the worst. And Pennsylvania Liquor Control Board, if you're listening, we're coming for you.
I'm not coming for you. Jamie Singular is coming for you. I got no beef.
I got so much beef. But I didn't want to order from the PLCB because they don't ship out of state. And I'm sure we'll have some out of state listeners. Crush Wine Company, they ship to most states. I think with the exception of Michigan and maybe a couple of others. I know Michigan has some really weird laws, so most places don't ship there.
All right. So what other business do we have to settle here?
I would like to
plug some things.
Yeah, some plugs, some shameless plugs. So I'm a member of a community of Instagram wine nerds called Summation Live. That's SOMMA. I can't spell.
No, it's not that. We're leaving this in. This is not getting cut out. Let's see if you can do it.
SOMMATION _ live.
Summation.
Summation live.
_ live.
We are live Monday through Thursday every week at 2 p.m. Check us out on Instagram for wine recommendations and general wine snobbery. Yeah, that's what I've got to plug. What do you got, homie?
Well, I got a couple things I think people should check out. People have to watch The Small Axe Cycle from Steve McQueen. Steve McQueen, one of our greatest living filmmakers, director of Hunger and Shame and 12 Years a Slave, and one of my personal favorite movies of the last 10 years, Motherfucking Widows from 2018 with Viola Davis and Liam Neeson and many, many, many others. Steve McQueen made what he's calling a cycle. It's five films all about British West Indian population in the 1970s. The first movie is called Mangrove, which is a based on the true story of the Mangrove Nine, who were put on trial for protests that turned into a riot because of violence from the police against the West Indian community that congregated around the Mangrove restaurant. Really exceptional movie. It's the movie that everybody maybe wanted the trial of the Chicago Seven to be. The Netflix Aaron Sorkin movie from earlier this summer. Mangrove I watched the other night and loved it. The second film in the Small Axe cycle is called Lover's Rock, which I saw as part of the virtual New York Film Festival earlier this year. And it's a 70-minute super sexy dance movie. Like, you're just at a club and they hang out and you feel like you're there. Like, it's the party everybody needs.
Nice.
So check out those. There's three more to come. I've loved both of the two that I've seen so far. Small Axe on Amazon Prime.
Dope. All right.
Those are my plugs.
Well, it's been a pleasure talking about this movie, and I'm going to go cry some more because it's real rough.
Well, James, we're not done. We have to tell the boys and girls in Radioland what they should be watching for next week.
Oh, that's true. Yeah. What did you decide? What's it going to be?
I did. We are going to be watching a movie called Dick Johnson is Dead.
Dick Johnson is Dead.
Dick Johnson is Dead. This is another Netflix film. It's exclusive to Netflix. It's a documentary from filmmaker and self-described camera person Kirsten Johnson. And it's she and her aging dad team up in a very lighthearted, very sweet documentary about death. Her dad is getting older and is showing signs of dementia. And while they're figuring out how they're going to change his living situation and how they're going to retire him, they stage his death in very elaborate ways. They bring in stunt people, like he gets hit by a car or an air conditioner hits him, all while documenting the process of him downsizing and moving into her New York apartment. And the movie really blurs the line between fantasy and reality. And it came out a couple of weeks ago. It's lovely. It's very sweet and funny and heartfelt, and I love it. It's one of my favorite movies of the whole year. And because it's a documentary and it came out on Netflix, it basically vanished after being discussed for 5 minutes, and I feel like people have just not seen it. So even if you're not a documentary person, like, you will just come to fall in love with both of these people by the time you watch this doc. Jamie, my wine adjectives for you. This movie is warm. It is dreamy. It's introspective. I do not have a color for you, but in terms of a visual, I will give you the note of glitter or sparkle. All
right. Okay.
Can I make a prediction?
Yeah.
You're gonna pick a bubbly.
No, I'm not. Just because you said sparkling, oh, fuck you. Okay. I'm not gonna do that because that's just who I am as a person. I don't do that. I'm very excited to have another really good cry because we're talking about a movie where someone's dad is dying. So that's fucking awesome.
Well, they're staging his death. He doesn't have like a terminal illness or anything. They are staging his death as a way for both of them to process him aging.
And eventually probably dying.
Well, I mean, he's a human being. Dick Johnson is not immortal.
So this is going to be Riesling from Germany. This is Julian Hart. That's H-A-A-R-T. The 1,000-liter cuvee, which is drawn out of a 1,000-liter fooder that he's got on the property. I believe the vintage is 2018. It might be 2019, though. And this can also be found at crushwineco.com.
All right. So there we have it. For our next episode, we'll be watching Kirsten Johnson's Dick Johnson is Dead. Available now on Netflix, a 2020 documentary. And we will be drinking
Julian Hart, 1,000-liter Riesling, coming from Germany.
Now, Jamie, if, let's say, our listening audience wants to actually have it as a pairing and watch the movie while they're drinking the wine, what should they do with the wine? How should they serve this one to themselves? Should it be chilled? Should it be decanted?
So if you don't have a wine fridge that's set at like an appropriate white wine temperature, you should put the wine in the refrigerator. You should take it out probably 20 minutes before you want to drink it. Then open it, pour it in a glass, and then pour from the glass into your face hole.
All righty. Well, Jamie, where can people find all of your takes, all of your hot takes? Where can they be found on the internet?
All of my hot takes.
Your scorching takes.
They can be found at my Instagram. That's at OrdinairePierre. spelled in the French way, Ordinaire Pierre. You can also just search Jamie Harrison Rubin and it'll come up. And you'll see a lot of bottle picks. And then in my stories, a lot of really just aggressive hot takes. And Scotty, where do we find your hot takes?
People can find all of my movie thoughts and also aggressive and relentless political retweeting on Twitter. I'm at OldManShudson or OldManSHudson. And you can also find a link there to my Letterboxd profile and see all the stuff that I'm watching and rewatching and a couple of my lists that are public. And you'll find out that I don't watch nearly enough because there ain't fucking time for that when you're an unemployed full-time dad. All right.
It has been a pleasure podcasting with y'all. I am Jamie. He is Scott. We are unemployed. You should all be staying home.
You should all be staying home. Cheers.
Cheers.
Hey, it's Future Scott. You made it. You made it to the end of the episode. It was good, right? Future Jamie, what do you think?
All of my parts were really good. Like, the stuff that I said was very interesting. But the stuff that you said was less interesting.
See, I mean, this might not surprise you, but I actually agree. I thought your stuff was good, and my stuff was, you know, sweaty and awkward, and it was a long walk for not a lot of payoff.
Sweaty and awkward. That's what we called you in high school.
That is what they still call me now.
So thanks everybody for listening. One more time, we got to ask, rate, review, and subscribe. It really helps other people find the show. And Scott clearly needs an ego boost. We got to get some followers here.
I mean, I would love some metrics. Metrics would be great to validate me. Jamie and I will be releasing the rest of our episodes on a bi-weekly basis on Fridays going forward. So tell your friends. Follow us on Instagram and Twitter at BiggerBottlePod, all one word, for updates, recommendations, and our usual bullshit. And now we're going back into the virtual recording studio, and we've got a bunch of new stuff coming up. So, yeah, subscribe and stay tuned.
Be safe out there, kids.
Cheers. Mazel.
Slancha, Kampei, L'chaim, Dostrovia.
I guess this is more your area. I don't know all the...
All the different ways to say cheers in other languages. Yeah. It's fun.
I don't know them. All right, that was the end of that take.